You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Brian London with me once again. Brian has been on the show before, and I suppose that most of you who are gold investors are well aware of who he is, but for those of you who may not know him, he has had a career spanning 3 decades in the investment markets. He serves as president and CEO of Jefferson Financial. It's a highly regarded publisher of market analysis and producer of investment-oriented events. Under the Jefferson Financial umbrella, Brian publishes the Gold Newsletter, and it's a cornerstone of precious metals advisories going back to 1971. He also hosts the New Orleans Investment Conference. That's the oldest and most respected investment event of its kind, and he's been around for a number of years. I've learned to know Brian through various investment conferences that I've been a part of as well, and I'm really glad to have him with us today. Thanks for joining us, Brian.
Great to be with you, Jay. As always, really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, it's great to have you. Before we get into, I want to talk about Waiting for the Turn, which is the title of your August newsletter. Before we get into that, just so we make sure we don't miss it, tell our listeners where they can go to sign up for the Gold Newsletter, and then perhaps talk a little bit about your New Orleans conference that's coming up on October 12th through the 15th.
Yeah, Gold Newsletter is real simple. It's goldnewsletter.com. And, you know, it's the oldest precious metals advisory out there. Jim started it. Jim Blanchard started it as his primary tool in advocating for the return of the right of gold ownership for American citizens in 1971. Once he was successful in that, and gold was about to be legalized in 1974, he decided to have an investment conference to teach American investors how to invest in gold. And that started the conference business, that now called the New Orleans Investment Conference. It's been going on. This is our 48th year this year.
Wow. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it's, you know, another blockbuster event this year, October 12th to the 15th, and featuring a lot of today's, you know, top analysts and thinkers in the markets.
Yeah, indeed. Some of them, I think, people like James Grant, Jim Rickards.
Yeah.
I see that Daniel DiMartino Booth is going to be there. Peter Buchvar, a lot of these people we've had on this show from time to time. Doug Casey. Lots of names that I recognize, Robert Prechter, lots of reasons to go. It is a conference that's the people do need to pay, and there's an admission price, right?
Yeah, just like Gold Newsletter has a paid subscription model. The conference is a paid attendance conference model, and, you know, it's different. There are no commercial presentations from the main stage. It's very content focused, I tell people that they get great advice and great insights from the stage, but the audience is equally valuable. There's it's a gathering of really smart people who search out their own information and come up with their own ideas and direct their own investments. So the intellectual atmosphere and environment is really stimulating.
I don't doubt it. Unfortunately, it's one of those things another conferences I've never gone to, even though I did talk to Jim Blanchard when he was still with us years and years ago, Brian, and regret that I've never made it. I still have to do it sometime, that's for sure. Maybe next year.
Absolutely.
All right. So I'm really waiting for the turn. We've titled the show today after the title of the headline in your newsletter, Waiting for the Turn, in gold, and we're seeing a little bit of a run up today. Do you think it might be starting?
Maybe. You know, Jay, you and I know better than to predict. we can predict a price or a time, but never both.
Yeah.
were smart enough to do that. It's tough to say. If you look at the charts, it looks like we had kind of a typical summertime bottom around the third week of July, right about where we would expect it, you know, using past experience. And then we started back up in kind of a stealth rally that long-time players in the market like you and I, we didn't want to call it a bottom. We didn't even want to look at it for fear that it would jinx it. But it sure looked like a bottom. And now we were kind of rolling over the last week or so. So I wrote yesterday in one of my pieces that if this trend continues, the best we could hope for would be a double bottom, if not a drop back below $1,700. But today looks good because the rationale for today's rally isn't much, you know, and when the metals move on pretty, thin excuses for a rally, then that shows a more bullish environment and that the sellers are exhausted. So I'm hopeful that today may mark a turn, but smart enough not to predict it.
Well, sure. Amen to that for sure. Well, Brian, I'd like to get your ideas as to why, you know, gold has not kept up with inflation recently. It has over the long term. We know that gold retains its purchasing power over not hundreds, but perhaps thousands of years. And so what are some of the dynamics, what are some of the underpinnings that have kept gold from performing, not keeping up with U.S. consumer inflation?
Yeah, Jay, I tell people that gold is not an inflation hedge. You know, the naysayers are correct in that respect. If they want, or if anyone wants to a real inflation hedge, they need to invest in oil or energy because mm-hmm. it's the only asset that's actually factored into the CPI. Mm-hmm. You know, the only thing that's actually going to track it tick for tick. But what gold is it's insurance against an inevitability, the ultimate, the eventual devaluation of fiat currencies and whatever your home currency may be. And as such, it acts more like insurance. You know, down here in the South, insurance rates go up the greater the risk is of a hurricane. And when there's a hurricane in the Gulf, you simply can't buy insurance at any price. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So that's what happens with gold. It's not so much a hedge against inflation, but it is a hedge against people freaking out about the future purchasing power of their currency. So it'll just kind of bop along, you know, in steady state, and maybe not do much for years and years. But when people start to finally get worried about what's going to happen to their currency, then they start buying gold, and you can see it go really exponential and even overshoot what would be equilibrium. So it makes up for lost time, in other words. So it's really a barometer of people's worry. And when people truly get worried about what's going to happen, then it reacts. And, you know, if you and I and other people who have been in the around for a while know that this is one of those environments that if people aren't already really worried, really freaked out about their currency, they're about to be. At some point over the next few years, they're really going to get worried. And that's when we're going to see gold react.
Yeah, there's certainly does seem to be a lot of things to worry about. That's always the case, but I don't know. Maybe it just seems like there's more things now than other times in our lifetime. I'm old enough to remember the 1970s when we had essentially double-digit inflation, at least a bit of it. Yeah. And it reminds me an awful lot of what's going on now. Oil prices were going to the moon then. There seemed to be, for various reasons, geopolitical factors coming into play then as they are now. So it really seems like there's a lot of reasons to own gold now, buy that insurance before it's hard to get it, I guess, is the message you're giving.
There's a lot of differences from between today and the 1970s as well. You know, first off, if you measured inflation just by the CPI, not Wall Street's painted, you know, inflation expectation gauges. But if you measured inflation as we did in the 1970s, and actually, as we know, that's not the same because they messed up the CPI.
Yeah.
But still, if you use the CPI, then real rates are as negative today as at any time in the 1970s. So from that standpoint, it's very similar. The big difference now is debt, primarily federal debt. You know, back then, federal debt was about 30%, 30-35% of GDP. Today, it's closer to 130%.
Exactly.
So there's nothing that can be done. You know, Volcker hiked interest rates above the rate of inflation. Powell and his cronies don't have that same toolbox. They can't do that because of the size of the debt. It would just completely blow the federal budget out of water and, in fact, exacerbate the problem itself because you'd get stuck in a much quicker debt spiral borrowing to pay interest on the federal debt. So it can't be done. So the Fed right now is powerless to fight inflation. And, you know, that's what I think is going to come in to really boost gold shortly. I think sometime this fall, October, November, we're going to see the cost of servicing the debt get to the point where it makes headlines. And interestingly so, it's already spiraled back to levels that precede the pandemic, back to pre-pandemic levels. It's really shooting up already and isn't factoring in a lot of the Fed's interest rate hikes yet.
Oh, exactly. And I've seen some academic studies that suggest that when you get to the level of debt to GDP that we have, the system simply can't take interest rates much beyond where they are now. And the argument from those fellows is that the system, that we're not going to have higher rates because the system simply can't take it. What do you think?
I think that's exactly right. I've actually been talking about that for a few years now. And that was before the pandemic and before the increase in the federal debt that we've seen as a result. It's a debt spiral. It is a debt spiral when you are borrowing money at much higher interest rates to pay the interest on the debt you already have. Things get exponential at that point in time, and the water just starts circling the drain ever more quickly.
Yeah, I take from what you said then that you don't believe, it seems like the mainstream discussion that we hear when you turn on Bloomberg or CNBC or whatever is that there's still confidence that the Fed can get us down to that 2% rate, you know, that targeted 2% rate for whatever reason. 2% was supposed to be the sort of dream rate of inflation was going to get us to nirvana. Obviously, you don't believe that's possible then.
Well, no, I don't. I think that for a lot of, you know, kind of wonky reasons, we're going to have higher inflation going forward or at least another wave of inflation. I think in the near term, we have reached peak inflation at around 9% or so, and it will fall back. But we don't have wage inflation yet really hitting the numbers. We don't have housing or rents really having their full impact, although those have come off the boil a bit. They never did get to the point where they impacted the CPI, and they're about to do that. So there's still a lot of inflation embedded in the system and embedded in people's expectations. It's anchored in expectations at this point and affecting habits and the like. And that's when you get into these cycles where the inflationary pressures start to reinforce themselves. So I think we're still going to have 5-6% levels of inflation. And then at some point, another wave is whatever happens down the road. So I don't think the Fed can do anything about it. And you know, so what happens then? Well, I think they have to give in at some point and start trying to rescue the economy. They can fight the inflation or they can fight the recession. They can't do both. And they may not be able to do either, but I think they're going to have to fight the recession at some point and give up the ghost on the inflation fight.
That's interesting because we've had David Stockman sort of shocked me when I had him on the show, and he suggested that we're not going to see any kind of pivot anytime soon from Powell, he thought, because he said that the policymakers, the Fed and the policymakers in Washington, are deathly afraid of an angry population, angry over the inflation situation, because, you know, Brian, there's something like half of our population lives hand-to-mouth, essentially, from one paycheck to the next. They have no savings. They have no ability to withstand the storm of any kind. And David's thought was that these guys are seeing, you know, people coming with torches and pitchforks, and that Powell is not going to change his mind. On the other hand, when I, you know, read people like Matthew Pippenberg, you know, his view is that the Fed was always there to create inflation, make sure the government was funded. So I guess you would probably be more in the Pippenberg camp than in the Stockman camp on this issue.
Well, I appreciate what David's saying in that it is, it especially for the lower echelons of economic wealth. Mm-hmm. Inflation is just absolutely debilitating. It, you know, the rich can avoid it. The rich can even profit from it. But it is absolutely disastrous for anyone who's living paycheck to paycheck. So I totally appreciate that point. The other point is, however, that with debt this high, they can't get the interest rates above the rate of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing what is essentially a 40 some odd year process playing out in front of us. I do this in my presentations, I show a chart of the Fed funds rate going back to the early 1980s, mm-hmm. when Volcker actually started to come off of pull back his medicine of ultra high interest rates.
Right.
What you see is that during any point when there's a recession or anything that was kind of a hiccup in the economy or perceived potential hiccup in the economy, the Federal Reserve had the same prescription in each case. It lowered interest rates. And you can see these interest rate bottoms of these rate cut cycles, one after another, like a stair step going from the second story down to the foundation to the first floor. And then it just bounces along at zero a couple of times, 2008, obviously 2020. And where do we go from here? Well, the Fed comes up with all these other policies, you know, from TARP to QE to every other acronym to try and rescue the economy. And every time they do this, they have to do more. They have to have more monetary adrenaline, more of the monetary drug for the addict who has developed a tolerance. So the markets and the economy, they're not addicted to easy money. They're addicted to ever easier money.
Right.
And so the next time they're going to have to do yet more and more and more. The bottom line is that this long 40 some odd year process from the end of the 1970s to today is reaching its end game. Now, I don't know if this cycle is the bust that destroys the dollar, like Peter Schiff believes, or whether they're able to kick the can down the road for a couple more cycles or so. But I think it is, number one, not a dollar issue. It's a fiat currency issue. Mm-hmm. All fiat currencies are running down the hill together. Sometimes are in the lead, sometimes some lag, but they're all going down the hill together. So I think it's a fiat currency issue. And I think we're in the end game. And I don't know what the precise path ahead may be, but I do know you're going to want to own gold, silver, tangible assets, you know, and associated investments going into it.
Well, certainly, from what I understand, China and Russia and a lot of central banks around the world are building up their gold reserves. Doesn't seem to be a concern with most Western banks, central banks, as far as I know. But this would seem to be, you know, and Alistair MacLeod, who we have frequently on this show, just wrote an article called Geopolitics, The World is Splitting in Two, in which he points out Russia and China. I think he includes India in there as well, with something like 54% of the world's population compared to the NATO bloc with something like 19% of the world's population. I believe those are the numbers. There does seem to be something coming in terms of geopolitical monetary structure. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, there is. And, you know, sovereign nations, particularly Russia and China, are smart. They know that whatever's happening isn't good, and whoever owns the gold is going to have the most power and say in what comes next. The U.S. is actually in pretty good shape because whatever the reset is, it's very likely to include gold as some sort of an anchor. To instantly give credibility back to currencies, you can connect them to gold. And it doesn't have to be a set gold standard. You know, Nixon caught a lot of deserved heat for closing the gold window and dissociating the dollar from gold. He didn't have a whole lot of choice. I mean, the vaults were being emptied. One thing he could have done was just devalue. Mm-hmm. Keep the connection, but just make, you know, more dollar, raise the price of gold.
Right.
Effectively. He could have done that. The problem with that is it's an admission of failure. Mm-hmm. Instead of having this behind the scenes ongoing inflation depreciating the purchasing power and nobody really to blame, when you devalue, the blame is directly on your shoulders, and it makes news and everybody sees it. But I think we're going to get to some kind of a position like that where the dollar is associated with gold and all fiat currencies, frankly.
Yeah. Just less than 2 minutes left here, Brian. What do you see for the gold share markets? I know you certainly follow gold in your newsletter. You have a lot of favorite companies you write about. Might we see a turn there pretty soon?
Yeah, that turn will come with gold. You know, I have a lot of friends, as you do, that are involved in those markets and the mining stocks, and they talk about how bad sentiment is, for the junior mining shares and, you know, how hard it will be to turn around that sentiment. And I tell them it doesn't really matter what the sentiment is. It's going to follow gold, and gold does not care what the sentiment is on Bay Street or anything. You know, gold is going to be moved for other reasons and I think upward. And I think that will turn that market. So if you want to know where the mining shares are going to go, you need to try and figure out or see where gold itself is going to go, because silver is going to follow gold. The mining shares are going to follow the metals, and it'll all happen in order. But you need to get the gold price up first.
All right. I think maybe we're on our way, fingers crossed, but we'll see. Thank you so much, Brian, for being with us. Your insights are greatly appreciated, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
Would love to, Jay. Really appreciate it.
All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week. Next week, my guests will be Keith Weiner of the Monetary Metals, and Michael Oliver will return as well. Until next Tuesday, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.